Before we even introduce today's deep dive, I want you to hear a premise that completely upends standard finance.
Right. So imagine a business where growth is completely free, entirely irreversible, and honestly entirely invisible to Wall Street's smartest analysts. Gravity just doesn't apply, traditional valuation models break down, and by the time institutional money catches on, well, the early investor has already won. Today, we are stripping down the physics of the market's rarest assets.
That is exactly the core of what we're unpacking today. Welcome to the deep dive. We are stepping way outside the standard Wall Street playbook here.
Yeah, way outside.
I mean, no typical price-to-earnings ratios, no standard linear growth projections. We're looking at a highly specialized framework from the Averaging Up Mental Models collection.
Right, specifically a text called the A Paramount, when gross dissolves into the toll.
Exactly. And our mission for you today is to completely rewire how you look at compounding businesses. We're looking at these ultra-rare companies that they fuse their present-day revenue with these unstoppable future macroeconomic waves.
It's a profound departure from how institutional analysts are taught to view the market.
Right, because usually analysts look at human execution, right?
Exactly. They look at a CEO making decisions or, you know, a marketing team trying to launch a product, a company fighting for market share.
Your usual corporate grind.
Yeah, but this framework just discards all of that.
Yeah.
It asked us to look at the market through structural inevitability. We're looking for forces that are so massive, so entrenched in the global economy that they don't even look like corporate initiatives anymore.
They just look like natural law.
Right, like natural laws. And if we can understand the mechanics of these forces, we can spot mispriced assets that the smartest institutional models are, mathematically speaking, programmed to miss.
So let's get right into the architecture of this. To understand this blind spot, the text gives us a foundational formula with two variables, A and B.
Yeah, A and B.
And the distinction here is basically the bedrock of the whole thesis. So A represents the toll, the cash collected today.
Right, it's the existing infrastructure. If you own a bridge, A is the actual toll booth taking the coins from the cars currently driving over it.
Okay, and B represents the wave, so the future growth.
Exactly. B is expanding into new markets, launching new product, maybe buying a competitor.
Yeah.
Now, in a traditional great business, you want these two to interact multiplicatively.
So A times B.
Yes. You want A multiplied by B, not just A plus B.
Let's break down that math mechanically, because if a standard company, say a hardware manufacturer, builds a new widget, that's usually just A plus B, right?
Yeah, it's purely additive. They have the revenue from the first widget, and they add the revenue from the second. But it's linear.
Right, because it requires a whole new factory.
A new factory, a new supply chain, a separate marketing budget.
But a true compounder, like a platform or a network, that creates an A times B scenario. The toll multiplies against the wave, so you don't rebuild the infrastructure for every new user.
Exactly. The business compounds geometrically.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's the standard definition of an excellent business. But the text asks a very specific question here.
What happens in the rarest cases?
Right. What happens when that wave of future growth is so dictated by the natural shifts of the world that it becomes completely gratuitous?
Uninvited and guaranteed.
Yes. It takes zero effort from the company. The text argues that in these incredibly rare instances, the wave completely dissolves into the toll.
So the B completely embeds into the A. There's no seam between the cash collection today and the growth engine tomorrow.
None at all. It's not a business riding a wave. It's a monolithic entity where the toll itself inherently contains the future.
The A is the B and the B is the A.
Right. And that seamless fusion is what the text calls the A paramount.
Okay. But identifying this is critical because, according to the text, Wall Street is fundamentally blind to it.
Structurally blind. Traditional models just can't price an asset where the growth engine has dissolved into the toll.
I have to push back on that, though. I mean, the idea that Wall Street is blind feels like a cliche. We're talking about institutions that buy credit card data streams, right?
Oh, absolutely.
They have armies of Ivy League quants, algorithmic supercomputers, satellites tracking parking lots. So how can they possibly miss a massive growth engine? Let's use the text's main case study, Visa.
Visa is the perfect example.
Right. It processes trillions. It's one of the most heavily scrutinized companies on Earth. An analyst looking at Visa clearly sees the steady, massive growth in transactions. It's not a secret. So why is Wall Street blind to the dissolution? What's breaking in their models?
Well, the failure is embedded in the actual tool every analyst relies on, the discounted cash flow model, the DCF.
Ah, the classic spreadsheet.
Right. When they calculate Visa's intrinsic value, they project future cash flows out, say, 5 to 10 years. But, you know, a dollar tomorrow is worth less than a dollar today.
And a dollar 10 years from now is highly uncertain.
Exactly. So they have to apply a discount rate to pull those future earnings back to a present value. And historically, for a blue chip company, that discount rate is hard-coded at around 8 to 10%.
Let's open up that 8 to 10%. What is that number actually measuring?
It's a mathematical penalty. It's a proxy for risk.
Execution risk.
Yes. Will the CEO make a massive capital allocation error?
Or competitive risk, like a rival stealing market share.
Right. Or macroeconomic risk. It's a heavy anchor on future earnings because achieving growth usually requires human execution and humans fail.
But this is where the framework exposes the whole flaw. Visa's growth, that B-wave, carries absolutely zero execution risk.
To zero. It doesn't rely on a visionary CEO. It doesn't need a brilliant new ad campaign or, you know, unproven R&D.
It just relies on one inescapable reality. The global economy is going to process more digital transactions tomorrow than today.
Exactly. The shift from physical cash to digital payments is a natural, gratuitous wave. Visa has no execution risk to capture it because their toll infrastructure is already globally embedded.
They just sit there and let it wash over them.
They don't have to fight for it at all.
Which means the analyst's spreadsheet is broken. If there were no execution risk, applying an 8 to 10% discount rate is just, it's a massive analytical error.
You're penalizing the company for risks that physically do not exist within the asset.
And if your discount rate is too high, the resulting valuation, the price to earnings ratio you assign, is structurally too low.
The market prices Visa as a traditional compounder. It runs the DCF, applies the standard penalty, and gets a price. But the framework prices it as an A paramount, a toll fused with a riskless wave.
And the gap between those two prices, the broken model versus the true value of frictionless growth, that's what the text calls the margin of expansion.
Right, the margin of expansion. It's like trapped kinetic energy.
Because the analyst is desperately looking for a seam between the toll and the wave. They want to isolate B as a quantifiable corporate initiative.
And when they can't isolate it, they default to the historical discount rate. They completely miss the A paramount.
It's not that they're not smart. It's an institutional constraint.
Exactly. It's a structural mispricing.
But this brings up a massive mechanical problem. If this asset is structurally invisible to Wall Street, how does capital actually find it? How does the price ever go up to reflect reality?
That leads directly into the structural sequence the text defines as the two doors of capital entry.
Right. The sequence of how money flows into an A paramount. And it's not random.
No. It's strictly dictated by the physics of market liquidity, and this sequence is exactly how the individual investor beats the institution.
Okay, let's break down door number one. The text is very explicit here. The first door opens exclusively for the small investor.
By small investor, they mean retail allocators, individual investors. Exactly. But there's a crucial distinction. The small investor doesn't enter door number one because they're necessarily intellectually superior to a hedge fund manager.
It's purely because they lack structural barriers.
We have to look at liquidity mechanics. The text uses MSCI as the primary example of an A paramount.
Right, the global index provider.
Right. So at the time referenced, MSCI had a market cap of $45 billion. Now imagine an individual investor sees the paramount structure there.
Or see the free growth that institutions are missing.
Yeah. So they decide to allocate, say, $50,000.
A $50,000 buy order on a $45 billion asset is subatomic. It's a rounding error.
It vanishes into the daily trading volume. It doesn't widen the bid-ask spread. It doesn't move the closing price by even a fraction of a cent.
And crucially, no regulatory tripwires. The SEC doesn't care. Wall Street algorithms tracking unusual volume don't even blink.
Exactly. The small investor quietly accumulates because door number one is wide open, completely unguarded.
Usually, illiquidity and market invisibility are negatives. Wall Street hates assets they can't move massive blocks of capital in and out of.
But for the retail allocator, that invisibility is the ultimate structural advantage.
Yeah.
They position themselves before the broader market reprices it.
Which brings us to the barrier of door number two. This door is built specifically for the large allocator.
The text uses Chris Hahn for this, the billionaire activist manager of TCI Fund Management.
He runs tens of billions of dollars. Why is door number one locked for him? Why can't he just quietly buy in like the retail investor?
Because of the sheer mass of his capital. Capital at that scale creates massive friction.
Right.
If Hahn wants to establish a meaningful position, let's say a $1.6 billion allocation in MSCI, he physically cannot do that silently.
A $1.6 billion order is roughly 3.5% of the entire outstanding share float.
Exactly. If his prime broker executes that on a random Tuesday, the gravitational pull of that order strips the order book clean. The stock price rockets upward violently.
He'd ruin his own entry price just by trying to enter.
Right, so he's structurally forced to wait. He has to wait for a massive liquidity event.
Like an earnings report that completely surprises the market.
Yes. Or a macro shift that causes institutional portfolio reshuffling. He needs the ocean to get turbulent so he can hide the wake of his massive submarine.
I love that analogy. The text makes a really critical terminology distinction here, too. It calls the small investor's entry natural.
Because it's completely frictionless.
Right. But it describes the institutional entry as mechanical.
When TCI moves $1.6 billion, it takes complex execution algorithms, months of accumulation, liquidating other assets. The market gears physically grind to fit that mass.
This totally redefines Peter Lynch's famous advice. You know, Lynch managed the Magellan Fund and always said the amateur investor had an inherent edge over Wall Street.
Yeah, but Lynch thought it was observational. Like, the retail investor could walk through a mall and see a crowded store before the analyst got the quarterly sales data.
But this text strips that thesis down to the studs. The edge isn't observational. It's not about noticing crowded parking lots.
No, the edge is entirely chronological. Chronology is the edge.
Because institutional capital is mechanical and heavy, its entry is a violent event. When Chris Hahn finally pushes through door number two, the SEC requires a 13F disclosure.
Let's explain that 13F mechanic, because it's the specific tripwire.
Right. U.S. regulations state any institutional manager over $100 million must file a Form 13F disclosing their equity holdings.
But here's the critical lag. They have 45 days after the end of the quarter to file it.
So by the time Wall Street sees the filing and realizes a titan like Chris Hahn took a massive position, the accumulation is totally finished.
The market suddenly wakes up, algorithms react, the herd mentality kicks in, and the asset is violently repriced.
The multiple rapidly expands.
And where's the small investor while the institutions are fighting over the stock?
They're already sitting in the room. They walked through door number one maybe years prior.
Right. They didn't need a superior financial model. They just recognized the invisible dissolution of the growth into the toll.
They took their position and let the heavy machinery of the institutional market drive the multiple expansion for them.
That chronological sequence is everything. But, you know, once that massive capital pushes through door two, we enter a phase where standard financial models just fail completely.
The text calls this the physics of suspended gravity.
Right, suspended gravity.
This is where traditional value investors experience massive psychological dissonance. Let's look at mean reversion.
The standard market behavior.
Right. Usually, if a blue chip company hits a PE of 30, mechanical selling pressure emerges.
Value investors see a PE of 30 and think the price overshot the fundamentals. So they sell to lock in gains.
And that selling pressure acts like gravity. It pulls the multiple back down to an equilibrium of, say, 15. The high multiple is treated as an anomaly.
But the text asserts definitively, gravity does not apply to an A paramount.
It uses the term free surfer interchangeably here, right?
Yes. An asset riding a free, gratuitous wave. In free surfers, those traditional sellers don't emerge, or if they do, they get immediately washed out by the fundamentals.
Why, though? Why does gravity fail?
Because the intrinsic value of a free surfer is unmoored from static averages. That B wave, the unstoppable macro shift, it never stops.
Every quarter, it forces more volume, more data, more revenue through the toll.
And completely for free.
So we have to look at the denominator in the PE ratio, the earnings. If a traditional value investor looks at a free surfer trading at a PE of 35, they feel sick.
It looks reckless. It violates Benjamin Graham's principles.
It looks like a textbook bubble.
Only if you assume earnings are static or require execution risk, but the text states that at a PE of 35, the market is perpetually undervaluing the free surfer.
Because the fundamental value is accelerating faster than the stock price can capture.
Exactly. The growth is free and guaranteed. The earnings denominator expands rapidly. So a PE of 35 today might mathematically represent a conservative PE of 15 when measured against the guaranteed earnings coming in 24 months.
The floor beneath the stock is relentlessly rising.
The company doesn't have to execute a risky venture to justify the multiple. The wave justifies it.
When a value investor demands a low multiple they're demanding compensation for a risk that physically does not exist.
They're applying the physics of a normal business to an anomaly, which leads to a really actionable rule from the text.
Once a free surfer passes through door number 2 and becomes visible, it rarely trades below a PE of 30.
Almost never. If you're waiting for Visa or MSCI to mean revert to a 15 PE, you'll be waiting forever.
If the market has a panic and drags the PE down into the 20s, the text demands you view it as a momentary breakdown in efficiency.
It's a temporary gift. Gravity is suspended because the free wave overpowers the psychological gravity of historical multiples.
But to really grasp the sheer velocity of this growth, the author demands strict mathematical precision about how these waves function.
Yeah, this is a critical correction in the framework.
The text takes a very sharp, almost combative tone here regarding notation. Early iterations of this model described an asset riding multiple waves, a coupled free surfer, using the shorthand B squared.
And the text explicitly states that notation is mathematically flawed. Conceptually dangerous, actually.
The mandatory notation is B1 multiplied by B2.
Right. And it might seem pedantic, an exponent versus a multiplication sign, but it describes entirely different physical realities.
So?
Well, B squared implies a single variable, one structural wave compounding on itself, exponential growth of one force.
But a coupled free surfer is more complex. Let's look at double naturality using MSCI. What is force 1, the B1 variable?
B1 is the macro trend of passive migration. Over the last 2 decades, trillions of dollars systematically migrated from active mutual funds to passive index benchmarked ETFs.
The John Bogle Vanguard revolution.
Exactly. Low fee market matching returns statistically beat high fee active management. It's a permanent structural replumbing of global finance.
Every time a retail 401k buys the S&P 500, MSCI collects a microscopic licensing toll.
The money moves mechanically and MSCI collects passively. That's the unstoppable B1 wave.
Okay, what is force 2, the B2 variable?
B2 is the adoption of artificial intelligence and algorithmic automation in finance. The modern market is run by server farms, not humans in trading pits.
Right. Quants, compliance algorithms, portfolio managers.
And they require unimaginably massive, pristine data sets, historical pricing, risk models, ESG scoring.
And MSCI is the premier toll booth for that data consumption.
That is the independent B2 wave.
So we have passive migration on one side, AI data consumption on the other. Two massive, entirely distinct structural shifts. Now, why does the multiplication sign matter?
Because B1 times B2 means these forces interact. They cross-pollinate. Think of a forest fire.
Okay.
B1's the dry timber, the raw fuel. B2 is the wind. A massive fire doesn't just burn fuel. The intense heat alters atmospheric pressure, creating its own wind system.
Which drives the fire faster, which creates more wind.
It's a self-sustaining thermodynamic loop.
Okay.
And that is the exact mechanical feedback loop of a double swell free surfer.
AI adoption accelerates passive investing efficiency.
Right, because algorithms are perfect for rule-based index tracking.
And simultaneously, the capital flowing into passive funds generates an exponentially larger ecosystem of financial data,
which the AI must consume to operate.
Yeah.
They feed each other infinitely.
And MSCI sits right at the epicenter, collecting a toll on both the capital flow and the data consumption.
To really highlight how rare this double swell is, the text contrasts MSCI with another legendary toll bridge, FICO.
The Fair Isaac Corporation. Their credit scoring model is the universal standard.
Every time a mortgage, auto loan, or credit card is originated in the U.S., a toll is paid to FICO.
So FICO is undeniably an A paramount. The growth dissolves into the toll. But how does it differ from MSCI structurally?
FICO is incredibly powerful, but it's primarily riding a single massive swell, the long-term historical expansion of consumer credit.
So it's an A multiplied by B structure.
Exactly. The toll mechanism is perfect. The credit expansion wave is gratuitous, but it lacks that intersecting, self-accelerating second independent wave.
It lacks double naturality.
Right. FICO dominates a single macroeconomic force.
Hmm.
MSCI captures the violent collision of two independent forces. That's why the coupled free surfer is the absolute rarest species of asset.
This structural dominance leads us right into the life cycle of these assets. How does a double swell free surfer go from being ignored to being the consensus darling of Wall Street?
The text outlines a rigorous 10-step sequence for this. It's the chronological blueprint of market behavior.
Let's trace it. It begins with the invisible phase, steps 1 through 3.
Right. In step 1, the macroeconomic tectonic plates shift. The B waves start to build, but there are no press releases.
The company's forward guidance doesn't even capture it.
and Wall Street analysts chained to their quarterly DCFs completely ignore the underlying physics.
So door number one is wide open. Step two is the entry of the small, unconstrained investor.
Because there's zero market friction. The retail allocator takes their position in the dark, insulated from institutional noise.
And then step three, the math of B1 times B2 begins to execute silently. Volume compounds, data consumption accelerates.
The fundamental value expands massively, but the stock price might stay completely flat. The market hasn't noticed the pressure building in the pipes.
Then we hit the inflection point. Steps four and five, the first expansion. Step four is the trigger of visibility.
It could be an earnings report that shatters expectations, forcing analysts to rebuild their models, or that delayed 13F filing we talked about.
The camouflage vanishes. The market sees the dissolution.
Which forces step five, immediate expansion of the multiple. The asset is violently repriced. A PE of 15 rips to a PE of 30.
Creating a twin-engine compounding effect for the early investor. They capture the earnings growth and the capital appreciation of the higher multiple, then secrets out. Step six and seven, the institutional crush.
Step six is the heavy machinery arriving. Door number two is kicked off its hinges. Sovereign wealth funds, giant index providers, they realize they're structurally underweight.
But there's a finite supply of shares.
So the sheer physics of their capital forces. Step seven, a second massive multiple expansion. The billions of dollars in mechanical buying pressure physically coerce the market into pricing it as an inescapable monopoly.
Which creates a psychological loop for everyone else. We enter the final phase, steps 8 through 10, speculation and suspended gravity.
Right. Step 8 is purely speculative, retail momentum capital arriving. Fear of missing out.
Traders buying just because the chart is moving vertically.
The text notes this phase is pure noise. It inflates the PE to terrifying levels, maybe 40 or 50.
But the genius is in step nine. Through all the 13F filings, the frenzy, the volatility, the fundamental equation just ignores the market.
B1 times B2 continues executing in the dark. The structural wave delivers massive earnings regardless of Wall Street's euphoria.
And finally, step 10, gravity remains suspended. That PE of 40 eventually normalizes because the relentless earnings growth catches up to the inflated price.
The denominator expands, compressing the multiple back to 30 and setting up the next cycle. The market is perpetually a step behind. The wave is perpetually a step ahead.
The ultimate lesson of this sequence is almost painfully simple. The investor who recognized the physics at step two walked through door number one and then successfully did absolutely nothing.
They capture the entire sequence, the silent compounding, the first multiple expansion, the institutional force, and the long tail protection.
The edge belongs entirely to early chronological positioning and total physical inaction.
But inaction is the hardest psychological state to maintain.
Right. When the multiple expands in step five, every instinct tells you to sell, secure the profit, wait for a mean reversion that will never come.
Which leads right into the most philosophically dense segment of the text. The author distills this whole framework into exactly 14 load-bearing words.
Let's examine this core thesis. The quote is, "A free surfer, and particularly the coupled free surfer, is a productive rare asset, undervalued because invisible."
Every single word there has to bear the weight of the framework. Remove one, and the structure collapses.
Let's start with the first requirement, productive. Why must it be productive?
Without productive, you just have an asset that is rare and invisible, like gold or fine art.
Gold is incredibly rare, but it's sterile.
Exactly. An ounce of gold doesn't generate another tenth of an ounce over 10 years. It doesn't produce cash flow.
Rarity without a pull mechanism is just a collectible. You're relying on a greater fool.
A free surfer must possess a toll bridge that extracts tangible, compounding cash from the world today.
Second word, rare. If we have a productive asset, but it's common, what happens?
Then you just have a traditional high-quality business, like a successful regional bank or a consumer goods company. They produce massive cash, but they are entirely common.
Wall Street understands them perfectly.
Quants have decades of data on thousands of similar companies to build their DCFs against. The text emphasizes only a microscopic fraction, maybe fewer than five companies globally, pass the coupled free surfer test.
It's that absolute rarity that breaks the institutional consensus. They lack the historical templates to model it correctly.
The extreme rarity forces the mechanical mispricing.
Which brings us to the final phrase, undervalued because invisible.
Remove invisible, and you have a productive, rare asset that the market already understands. Think of a dominant tech monopoly at the peak of a bull market,
Everyone knows it's an incredible business.
Because it's highly visible, it's priced to mathematical perfection. There's no margin of expansion. The invisibility is the physical cause of the undervaluation.
Because the B wave has dissolved into the toll, there's no trackable growth initiative, so the market applies an 8% execution penalty to a riskless wave.
It's a monumental philosophical shift. This framework completely inverts Benjamin Graham,
a father of value investing, Warren Buffett's mentor.
Graham trained generations to protect themselves through a mathematically cheap purchase price. The cigar butt approach.
Right. Calculate the liquidation value, demand a massive discount, and that discount is your margin of safety. Buy a dollar for 50 cents.
Safety strictly through price compression.
So how does the free surfer framework invert that margin of safety?
It abandons price compression entirely. It replaces it with the physics of momentum. It protects you through structural inevitability.
When you find an A paramount where the growth is gratuitous and irreversible, you don't need a low PE for safety.
The inescapable force of the business compounding over decades provides the ultimate margin of safety.
Even if you buy at what looks like an elevated multiple, the relentless delivery of free future earnings violently compresses that multiple over time.
The guaranteed expansion of the business becomes the margin of safety. You aren't protected by a distressed entry price. You're protected by attaching your capital to an unstoppable physical force.
The emotional difference there is staggering. The traditional value investor lives in constant anxiety, fighting the market consensus, hoping for one last puff of the cigar.
While the free surfer investor walks through door number one and lets macroeconomic physics do the heavy lifting.
We have exhausted the mechanics of this text, but as you're listening to this, I want to leave you with a final, highly resonant thought drawn from the poetic conclusion of the source text.
It really is haunting.
Yeah. The guide watches from the mountain. The wave builds offshore, the vase sits on the shelf, and the margin expansion belongs to the one who saw it first and touched nothing. Look closely at your own portfolio, the tools and networks you use daily. Are you allocating capital to traditional businesses fighting bloody wars for market share, burning billions on unproven R&D? Or are you training your mind to look for the invisible tolls, the rare monopolies where growth is pushed relentlessly forward entirely for free by massive structural shifts in the global economy? The waves are building offshore right now. The B1 and B2 forces are accelerating. The only question is whether you possess the structural framework to recognize them before the heavy machinery of Wall Street kicks down the door.
To explore these investment strategies further and discover more from the collection, visit the website averagingup.com.